horse owner, I always wanted to take the best care of my horses so that riding them was comfortable for them. In the beginning, I didn't realize how complex that care really was. I assumed if I reached out to professionals, they would guide me in the right direction. However, I found out the hard way that it is not that simple. Finding the right professionals can be challenging, and I did not know enough myself to discern appropriately qualified professionals and advice that was accurate. As a result of my experiences and finding that others had similar issues, I decided to start Equitopia as a whole horse, whole rider, evidence-based informational platform that I wish I had access to myself from the beginning. I would like to invite you to visit us at equitopiacenter.com, where you will find this information provided in the form of webinars, blog posts, research papers, and more.
You're listening to the Equitopia podcast, helping horses and humans live in harmony. I'm your host, Kaylee Hansen, and today our guest is Caroline Haggerty. She is the founder of Equitopia, and I'm so excited to share her story and what brought her to create Equitopia. This is a great conversation, so let's dive on in.
It was strange because I didn't have anyone else in my family who was into horses, and I just got the bug when I was really young, like 6, 7. I just fell in love with horses, and I badgered my mom into getting me like toy horses, posters of horses, calendars of horses, t-shirts with horses on them, and she obliged. And eventually, as I got a little older, 7, 8, we went to the local riding school, and she got me some lessons. So that's how I started out.
Oh, cool. When did you first get into biomechanics?
Well, that was much later on. You know, as a youngster growing up in Ireland, there wasn't a lot of theory or any preparation. It was like just the horse is saddled up, you get on and you ride. And it wasn't until I actually came to America and I'd had a little break from horses, but I came and I started riding over here. And I hadn't done much arena work until I came here. As a matter of fact, it was the first time riding in an arena was actually here. And it just opened up my eyes to how much I didn't know. And so I started probably like most people, I think, with just, you know, surrounding myself with professionals, I will say, you know, saddle fitter, farrier, etc. But it was from the base of no knowledge. So I was literally relying on the professionals that I picked without having the skills to evaluate them. So it was just as I progressed through my journey with my horses and I became in tune with their behavior and started asking questions that I started realizing that I had a huge gap in my education that was not in line with my desire to keep my horses healthy and pain-free.
Was there a specific experience that caused you to realize you needed to dive a lot deeper?
A farrier experience where, you know, I started noticing that my horse's feet were changing shape. And I was like, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? I went online and I tried as best I could to get some information. But it was just intuitively when I watched in particular one session with my horse where literally her heels, I think the farrier probably must have taken half an inch off her heel. And she ended up with this big long toe and this like very low heel. And I literally had an argument with him. And I called the vet out who concurred with my evaluation that this was not a good thing and literally changed how my horse was moving on this. It was just on the right front. And it just completely made me take a real look at what is my role as an advocate. And it's like if I can't trust the professionals that I hire that are qualified, then what's wrong with this picture? So I came to the realization that I need to know at least enough to be able to evaluate the people that I call, I guess, to help me with the things like the feet, the saddle fit, nutrition, you know, and training. And it's really been a very and ongoing complex world to unravel in terms of the reality of what it takes to keep a horse safe, sound, and healthy, and to also make sure the rider has the necessary skills and frame of mind and emotional stability to actually put together, you know, this horse and rider combination that is ultimately operating at an optimal mental and physically healthy manner. And that's, and as I say, it's still ongoing. I'm, despite the fact that I've 5 years into researching and investigating these topics, I still find the more I know, the more I find out, the less I know. And I anticipate this journey is going to be ongoing for me personally, as I now look at how to care for my horses.
Yeah, I get overwhelmed with how much information is out there, and I know so much more than I used to, but I still, oh man, there's just so much more to learn. How did you get more into like the training methodology or all the other aspects? Or did you just start to really realize, okay, I'm having issues with hoof care, let me analyze what all these other things are too?
Yeah, I started questioning more. I realized that I was too passive in my role. Like and to be honest, again, there was a training issue where I questioned the trainer because I said, well, my horse doesn't look happy with what you're doing here. Can you explain it to me? And basically I was told, well, you don't know what you're doing. You're not a trainer. And this is how you train horses. And it was, again, an emotionally distressing situation for me, because on the one hand I was looking at my horse and I thought to myself, intuitively, this just doesn't seem right to me from my horse's perspective, but then I realized myself, I didn't know enough to be what I felt was a good custodian to my horse. And so I thought, well, if I leave this trainer, how do I know I don't go to another one that's just as bad, or is it bad? And it was just lots and lots of questions. And the big thing that I realized when I finally left this particular trainer was that it was better to have me not knowing a lot but loving my horse and being ultra cautious about how I rode, rather than giving them to someone who's, you know, very stuck in a philosophy or a way of riding horses that's not actually based on something. And that was my wake-up call to say, what qualified this person or any other person to train a horse and to tell me how to train my horse? Where is their education coming from? And what I found was a lot of professionals in the industry, it's hand-me-down. They do this because it's been done this way all the time, or because this is how they were taught by their person. But there was a complete lack of questioning of what you're being told, and for actually looking for signs that you're on the right track from the horse. Because if you are doing something to the horse, for the horse, then the best feedback you can get is going to be from the horse. And if you can't understand or read what the horse is telling you, then how can you be successfully applying whatever it is, whether it's a shoeing protocol or a training protocol or a saddle fit protocol? You're not applying it correctly if the horse is behaving in a way that says, no, this isn't working for me. And so that's when I started dismantling the whole thing and realizing, again, such a shocking lack of awareness and reliable resources in the industry. And it's fairly widespread, you know, culturally, where the reality of what we should be doing and what we should know and how we should be evaluating our success with our horses, assuming that their care and welfare and optimal training is what we're looking to accomplish, then we have a long way to go. We need to raise awareness, and we need to start asking these questions, and we need to start assembling some kind of theoretical and visual documentation of what it looks like when we get it right. Because again, you can't compartmentalize. If you have the best farrier in the world that does a fantastic job with your horse's feet, but the horse has a saddle that causes him to be hollow in the back and causes pain and causes them to compensate, then you're still going to get not a good result. So that's kind of, you know, again, has now been my journey. And it's very, very hard. It's very hard to accomplish, and it's very hard to find the right team who are willing to work together, have the appropriate experience and training, and are on the same page, and to get them to all work together to try to accomplish, again, a readily agreed upon visual of what the qualities and characteristics of a healthy, biomechanically operational horse and rider combination looks like. Again, where their mental and physical well-being is very obviously the priority.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have a really similar experience to that of just not knowing, maybe not agreeing with what the trainer is saying, but not having enough knowledge. And I love that. I definitely agree that it is better for someone who loves their horse to maybe do things a little, not sloppily, but to just be with their horse and listen than to be forced into a frame or a framework of training that is not always the kindest.
Yeah. I mean, there's nobody that knows these horses better than the person who sees them every day. And they're the best one with the most information that sometimes is not easily downloadable to someone who just appears for half an hour or an hour once a month or every 6 weeks to see the horse and try their best to make a judgment in that short space of time.
Yeah, most definitely. Where did you end up finding your information? Was it books, or did you connect with other horse people, or how did you go about that?
It was really just a bunch of bad experiences that gave me a little more confidence and a little more willingness to be okay with not having all the answers, but just learning to look at my horses and see what I see and trust my own instinct. And then I was just super cautious about the kinds of professionals that I would interview. And I kind of came to, at some point, a fairly close a relationship with people that were able to give me the kinds of results that I thought looked good. Again, they didn't have all the answers, but once I found those, then I thought, well, okay, if this is the result visually and mentally and behaviorally I'm kind of looking for my horses, I now want to delve into the various aspects of what it is everyone is telling me. So I started then saying, okay, well, if someone says this is how you should ride your horse, what is behind that? It was backtracking from my horses that I then thought, this is what I had envisioned for myself. As what I thought it would be like to have a good relationship with my horse and to have a good feeling when I rode them. So I kind of backtracked then, as I say, into like, okay, what is it that this person is doing? Where do they get their information? Can I validate what they're telling me with evidence and research? Because that's what I wanted. Because if I am having these experiences and I'm, you know, I guess become ultra skeptical then to say, how do I absolutely assure myself that the words that these professionals are telling me are actually matching what I want? Because it's very easy to talk the talk, but walking the walk is very is much more difficult. And so that's when I started delving into the, like, what is out there? How do you navigate what's out there and extract what matches the visual and the behavior that you want from your horse, if that makes sense? If I had in my head an actual, idea of what I would want to see from a horse that is healthy and sound and happy at their job and empowered to do their job, I wanted to find out, what can I do to support that? What makes sense? What matches it? Where do the words match the visuals? And that was kind of what I set out to do, is to say, what is it that puts all this together and helps me to identify, again, what is a happy horse? What are those things that allow me to get information from the horse's perspective that lets me as an owner know that they are mentally and physically feeling okay about what I'm asking them to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the words matching the visuals is what's really, really lacking, I feel like, because people will talk about, everyone wants their horse to be happy. They want it to be elegant and free-flowing, but then you'll see images or videos or what's winning, which is the opposite of that. And I think it gets people really confused as to what's true and what's not. So allowing people to, I feel like training your eye to know what is good is the most important thing, because then you can figure out what's working and what's not. That's more important than necessarily like having the hard skills of like knowing where you're trying to go.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and the thing is, at the end of the day, every horse and rider situation is so uniquely specific to that situation, because you can't discount the emotional history and the emotional state of again, what two beings come together, what's involved, and you start unraveling that. You know, horses are affected by their history just as humans are. And so, again, these things do impact the application of theory. You know, that's that outside component that's not definable. You can't write out and say, be relaxed around your horse, be open, be this, be that, and then have, you know, be able to relate to the horse the same thing. Forget about the, you know, maybe if they had a bad experience, you know, you can't just automatically, like magically, just take this theory and apply it to a horse that has baggage, whether it's physical or mental. There has to be a little unraveling. And that's why I think the power, for the most part, needs to be with the owners, the people who see the horse every day, that have the best chance at establishing a relationship that is going to be, again, emotionally as well as physically rewarding for both the horse and rider. Because isn't that what we want? I mean, should we not enjoy the time with our horses? Or should our horses not enjoy their time with us? I mean, is there a purpose beyond that that's worthy enough of what we try to do with these horses? I mean, that is the question we have to ask ourselves, you know, what do we want from these horses? And is it, I suppose, fair or ethical? I mean, that's really the bottom line for me anyway. And what I try to accomplish here at Equitopia is we do have to look seriously at our expectations of these horses versus the reality and what it takes to do so without harming them mentally or physically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of people forget that at the end of the day, we're just supposed to enjoy our horses, and they're supposed to enjoy us too. And those can go both ways. They aren't just a tool for us to achieve things. So I think that's a really good reminder for people. At the end of the day, if you just want to hang out with your horse, that is just as important as riding them, or more so. Yeah. So how did you start Equitopia? What was that process like?
Well, it was, I can't even remember. I think the first thing was I wanted to understand, again, the biomechanics. So one of the first videos we did was about the biomechanics of engagement. So, you know, when you talk about engagement of the core and the back raises and the dorsal spinous processes lift and separate as part of the lifting of the back through the engagement of the core. And I just said, but is that true? Does that actually happen? And I went to look for, you know, evidence that was the case. And so I didn't see anything there that was convincing. So that's the first experiment we did that was kind of a, if we're going to investigate this information, we have to have some level of validation. So we did the first experiment with UC Davis and Dr. Sarah Lejeune, where we went and we took x-rays of the horse with their back raised and with their back hollow. And it was quite a surprising result, the amount of space that opened up between the dorsal spinous processes on a horse that had their back engaged. It was a one-off experiment with Dr. Sarah Lejeune's own personal horse. You know, obviously you have to have a horse that you trust because, you know, we did I can't remember now actually how we did the raising of the back. I think it was it might have been a baited stretch, but anyway, it was and a hip tuck. It was a hip tuck, that's what it was. But you know, you have to be careful doing that. We had to have a little slight bit of sedation just to make sure that the horse wasn't terrified with all the huge x-ray equipment that came in. But if anyone hasn't seen it, it's a really super interesting experiment that pretty much validated again that when the core is engaged, that the dorsal spinous processes at the top of the spine do lift and separate some of them to quite a degree. And of course that also depends on their conformation, etc., etc. But it was the first experiment that we did that was again, confirming what we are talking about when we look to create good movement and good posture with these horses. What are the consequences? What are the set of muscles? What's the cause and effect on the bones, ligaments, etc.? And to watch out for what the horse is telling us also with their expressions as to are they okay with it? Is it working?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that video was really cool to be able to actually see the opening, and it makes sense so that the horse can better support the rider.
Yeah. So once I started with that, it was just a question of continuing. And we had a lot of consultants, you know, we consulted with Dr. Hillary Clayton, consulted with Dr. Sue Dyson on that video, just to say, is there anything that's questionable? And again, I will say that at the end of the day, there isn't anything that's always going to be black and white. Science doesn't have all the answers. It's just not possible when it comes to, again, you're taking a horse, a rider, saddle, bridle, bit. I mean, there's so many things going on with each horse and rider situation that it's impossible to just say this is the recipe for every single situation you're going to come across involving a horse and a rider. So you have to look at the whole horse and rider all the time. It's a moving target. It's not like, oh, hey, I've achieved this and now I'm off to the races. It's, you know, horses change every day, people change. And so you have to be constantly aware of what you're seeing in front of you on a daily basis and be self-aware to know what's going on with you on a daily basis, and that there is that balance between those two things. That, you know, if you've had a bad day and you're feeling frustrated, or if you're on a short time frame that you have to rush out of there, it's probably not a good thing to have a goal where you want to get something specifically done with your horse that day. So the willingness to let go of some of those things and know that there is a cause and effect with pretty much everything you do around a horse, because you're always training your horse basically, and they're always having an experience with you. And I think being mindful about how you interact with your horse and working with a methodology that you can always apply, a methodology that, you know, hopefully is rooted in that you want to always be kind to your horse, you want to always have them had a good experience, you want them to be optimally developed in terms of their performance without, you know, negative consequences to their well-being. And you apply that every day regardless, and you think about it the very first thing before you decide what you're going to do with your horse. You say, can I apply my methodology today, or am I not in the space to do it, or is my horse not in the space to do it? If, you know, horses can have, you know, again, an upsetting day, something can happen, they can lose a neighbor, lose a friend, you know, something scares them in the stable, and you have to recognize that when you go out and say, is trying to do what I want to do with my horse today in line with my methodology, given that I see my horse is very anxious at the moment, I don't know why, but it's not a good basis on which to pursue what I want to do with this horse today, because it's going to be a negative experience probably for both of us. So that's kind of...
Yeah, that's a really important perspective. People get really goal-oriented, and then they can kind of forget that sometimes you have to navigate around that. That can still be your end goal. But you have to ask yes questions, and that can change in each moment. You got to make sure that your horse and you can succeed in what you're asking them to do.
Yeah.
Definitely. Do you have a specific experience with a horse since you've learned so many more tools and knowledge? Have you been able to help any horses with that?
You mean personally?
Yeah.
I think at this point I have 14 horses. Two of them are my older horses. They're 30 years old. I had them for 22 years and they're retired. The rest of them have come from, you know, pretty bad situations. Some of them have turned out not to be rideable. I think there is one, he's a thoroughbred, that came in. He had kissing spines, ulcers. He's had some injuries, and he's the one that, I have been helping. I do ride him. It's unraveling. It's been a 3-year process to unravel some of his emotional issues, some of his physical issues. But at the moment, he is looking like a different horse, and he's actually managed to figure out how to be in balance at walk, trot, and canter, which makes me very, very happy. And he really, out of the 14, is the only one that I would feel is physically and mentally okay to ride. The rest of them are compromised really beyond being able to unravel within reason their history of compensatory issues leading to clinical issues that, you know, really have been unresolvable.
Do you think with a lot of those horses, do you think if things would have been caught earlier on, They could have been sound at this point.
Oh, absolutely. Not, I have not a doubt in my mind. The thing with some of these horses, I mean, one of them has a neurological issue and a physical issue called sabulocystitis, as well as the neurological. But the neurological obviously is not salvageable. One of the horses came in, it was an original, I would say, slip and fall that went untreated and undiagnosed to the point where, I mean, the ligament damage, the muscle damage, the atrophy, the compensatory issues that have changed literally like how he carries himself is just, I mean, it was quite dramatic, but it just, with all the vet treatments and the analysis, we were not able to do enough to reverse it. And at this point, we just kind of let him retire. But had it been caught early at the time, I mean, we're talking about this injury probably happened 5 years before he came to me. So, And the thing is, people were still trying to ride him. He was actually donated to a therapeutic riding facility. And again, they didn't recognize how unnatural his physique was. Like, I mean, he was overdeveloped in his gluteal muscles and his hamstrings. I mean, sorry, not gluteal. He was overdeveloped in his hamstrings, and you know, you could see the overdeveloped muscles from space. They were so rock hard to the point where he couldn't lift up his hind legs. But again, wow. It's the question of, you know, the owner didn't see it. And again, I'm going to say I've talked to the owner of this horse and she loved this horse. I mean, she did love him, but she didn't know enough. And so she didn't recognize what was happening with him. And this, again, is part of the problem with horses being compliant in spite of pain. A lot of them are. They're either explosive usually or they're compliant. And they will work through this until such point as they literally either cannot move or the pain becomes overwhelming and they finally just, you know, lose it and buck the person off or otherwise they're like this guy head bobbing lame and can't you know, couldn't buck because it's too painful. So this is where I always go back to the original mission of the person who sees the horse every day really is in the best position to be an advocate. And the only way you can be an advocate for these horses in a preventative way that stops them from ending up like the 14 that I have here, or the 12 really, is that we got to get ahead of this and we have to actually look into what do we see in front of us specifically when we look at this horse. What do we notice about them? Can we educate ourselves to recognize what if there's a deficiency in their top line? How do we know that? That is a sign. If you don't have muscle chains that are building up a top line in a way that's uniform for that horse, then it means there is a problem. Now, it could be more than one problem, but we have to know, first of all, that if the goal is the development of a healthy top line, which is a universally accepted outcome that we want when we train these horses, we have to know what it is. And we have to know when it's being achieved versus when it's not being achieved. And if it's not being achieved, then we have to stop and say, okay, why is this not happening? What is the problem? And we have to then learn how to identify it before it becomes an injury or before the horse keeps going to the point where they're head bobbing lame or they blow a tendon or they have a suspensory injury or they buck the rider off or whatever it is that is going to happen at some point or another, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have just kind of accepted a subtle amount of lameness as normal. People will be like, oh, that's just how they move, or, well, he was a little bit off, but he wasn't lame. And I think it's just so important to catch that before it turns into something that is irreversible. Because the earlier you can catch it, the cheaper it's going to be to fix, hopefully, the longer you're going to be able to enjoy your horse. And I think kind of changing that narrative that it's not normal for your horse to be a little bit off, or that's not normal, even if that's how they typically are, that means that something's wrong and it's been wrong. And so we need to investigate it. Because the behaviors come out.
It brings up a whole other topic again of gait analysis. If you're looking to evaluate whether a horse is sound or lame, then again, the layers of subtlety with what would be considered a normal gait versus a gait that's compromised, it's not widely recognized by professionals or owners alike that, you know, that if a horse isn't head bobbing lame, that that they don't see the compensatory pattern. They don't see if a horse is slightly off on their right front or they're compensating with their right hind or whatever it is. So there is definitely more training required for professionals. Because again, a lot of the people that come our way that have issues that are what I have to describe as chronic at this point, because we're talking about, again, the explosive rider's been bucked off or the horse is head-bobbing lame, then they're trying to unravel it with us as a last resort, because the whoever they've called in the past has failed to recognize that there actually is a soundness issue, that these horses are lame on multiple limbs is usually what happens with the cases we have. And the owners have just kept insisting that because of the behavior, which becomes unsafe or, you know, just unavoidably acknowledgeable as dead lame, then there has to be an underlying cause or multiple causes. And that's unfortunately the problem when the horse gets to head bobbing lame, is at that point you probably have multiple issues happening that have to be unraveled, because there's probably a primary lameness, there may be a secondary lameness, there may be a tertiary lameness, because as an initial minor injury or minor abnormality doesn't get addressed, then the compensatory patterns end up with creating more clinical issues because of the, you know, again, unequal load being brought to bear by the horse on its body as it tries to, you know, get around doing whatever they're being asked to do. So more training of professionals and specialization, I think, as well, is something that needs to be done, because, you know, again, the question is what qualifies someone to diagnose or work on your horse? We as owners have to ask ourselves that question. How do I know, or how do I evaluate this person is an okay person, knows enough, has enough experience that I'm going to let them work on my horse's teeth, or I'm going to let them work on my horse's feet, or I'm going to let them fit the saddle on my horse and tell me, you know, whether it works or not. I mean, we have to really start asking questions and be more assured and see the backup in terms of confirmation from our horse in their posture, in their attitude, in their facial expressions. We have to go back ultimately to the end judge, and that again is the horse. We have to be able to read what the horse is telling us about their mental and physical well-being, because that's ultimately the confirmation. They don't lie. Horses don't lie. And they're the only ones that can really give us that answer. They're the only ones that can say, yes, you know, this is okay. I feel okay about this. Yes, I can do this. Or versus, you know, this isn't so great. I'm doing it, but it's not fantastic for me. Or, you know, oh my God, this is the best ever, or this is horrible. No, this is definitely not working for me. Please don't ride me in this manner with whatever it is going on. So that's really, for me, is that's the journey, is how to become a confident advocate. Surround yourself with the kind of people that are going to help create that, you know, lovely, wonderful image of a horse that really is feeling, you know what, thanks very much. You've enabled me to do what you're asking me to do. You're asking me correctly. You've fitted me out to do this. And you know, that's the biggest thank you that we could get, I think, is and the biggest satisfaction is to really have confidence in the happiness level of our horse and their ability to do what we want them to do.
Yeah, most definitely. Putting the happiness of the horse first is most important. So kind of going back to the horse that you have that is sound enough to be rode, what were all of the things you did with him? Was it vet work, body work, hoof care? Kind of what were all those little pieces that had to come together?
The feet were the, oh my God, trying to figure out what was going on with the feet took a long, long time. He has very thin soles. I think he had some very bad experiences with his feet before he came on board. We tried therapeutic shoeing, which did seem to help, but then it was like the question of sole pressure. We had to figure out what was going to work with him. He had high-low syndrome, and that's why we did the therapeutic shoeing, and so it took a while to get that balance right, but then that led to other things, you know, affecting how he was landing, was it, things in the upper body with his kissing spines. He's had radial shockwave for the kissing spines. He was treated for ulcer with cefalcrate and what's the other one? Gastroguard. And he had repetitive ulcers, despite the fact that he, you know, we had him on, you know, forage, that he had access to forage all day long. But I guess we finally took him to a clinic to say, what is it that is making this horse have repetitive ulcers? And I guess he's got a predisposition to it. So he's now on like a hind gut supplement specifically to help him with the, you know, this prevalence for ulcers. And again, he didn't show a lot of signs with the ulcers. And he also had prior saddle fit issues, which possibly was related to the kissing spine. So he's had, shockwave. Chinese acupuncture was a huge help with him. He had a good series to clear some of the, like the more energy, you know, with his organs. And I'm a huge fan of Chinese acupuncture now. And let's see, what else do we do with him? Of course, he's had a saddle fit checked out. Bridle and bit fitting was another one for him. And and then it was just a question of unraveling his crookedness and his asymmetries to try and teach him how to move straight and, you know, to be relaxed with it. So a lot of groundwork, some beta stretches to help him with the development of the right muscles. And it was just a very coordinated effort all around, and to constantly be monitoring. You know, things with this horse is he's very sensitive, again, in his feet. So a millimeter, really, of a trim can be the difference. So it's like I watch how he lands after every single shoeing to see if he's landing in a correct manner or if there's any issues at all. And so me and my farrier have frequent conversations to make sure, and now we have it, that pretty much now every shoeing, and he still is shod and with the therapeutic shoes for now. Not sure if he could ever go barefoot, which we have a lot of horses barefoot, which, you know, probably is the healthiest form for feet. But this guy may never be able to do that. I don't know. So he still gets the regular Chinese acupuncture treatments, and, you know, gets a saddle checked on a regular basis. And that's really been it.
Okay. Yeah. It's nice when you're able to finally kind of have everything come together and get him to a more comfortable experience. So what are actions people can take to improve their riding, horsemanship, or like quality of life for their horse?
I really think, and this is my advice to myself at this point, you know, when I started out and I got my first horse, and he was very athletic, my first horse here, and I was thinking, I had dreams of being a Grand Prix show jumper, and then I had dreams of being a Grand Prix dressage rider. And the reality is, my expectations were far too high for my skill level, my experience, my access to resources, and really just for just having one horse. And so I think the best advice I can give to anyone is to set expectations that are realistic and to just be mindful and look for the joy in the time that you spend with your horse, regardless of what they can do for you. Because if you can get to that elemental level of just joy from being around them, which is what I had in the first place. As a 6-year-old, I had no desire of anything other than I just thought they were absolutely beautiful. I loved horses just for the sake of loving horses. I had no expectations of them. And it was only, you know, as I got more into the social element and a little bit of competition that these other things were projected onto me and I accepted them. But now I'm back full circle and I come to these horses that I have today, and I'm just amazed that at being around them, watching them, you can learn so much for just watching them on a daily basis, see how they live their lives, see how they interact with each other. It's a wonderful thing, and you can gain so much joy and peace from it in these lives that we currently live that are super busy. We're inundated with social media, inundated with all kinds of pressures and stresses. And it would be great if that was not part of our horse life. If we deliberately look at our horse life and say, I want this to be the enjoyable, no expectations, no pressures. I want this to be a source of joy in my life, because it will reflect in your horse's reaction as well. And that's that, again, lower your expectations, enjoy your time with your horse without expectation, I think is probably the best advice I could give to anyone.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I think that can go into every aspect I know, like, with my horse, one of my favorite things is just letting her loose in the arena and watching her roll and then run and buck and then come right up to me with a super happy, eager face, like, okay, what are we gonna do next? Like, that's my favorite part of being around my horse.
And, you know, the funny thing is, I was thinking about this recently is, again, when I thought about how do we change and adapt, get culture to adapt to, like, looking at these horses differently, where they're not just objects. And I thought about how we look at dogs. Like, most people will, you know, without exception, I'd say, recognize the difference between a dog that's happy and a dog that's dejected or in pain. Like, you recognize their body language and their expressions. And mm-hmm. and it's realistically no different with horses, but it's just people aren't aware, and it's more subtle, perhaps. You know, you don't have a big wagging tail, and you know, or a tail that's clamped between the legs. But there are equally, you know, species specific signs in our horses that we just need to learn in order to be able to, again, readily identify, as we do with dogs, a happy dog versus a dog that's not.
Yeah, I think people oftentimes misinterpret what horses are, what their behaviors are saying. Like, they anthropomorphize them. I'm like, nope, that's not, horses don't think that way.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So how has a failure or apparent failure set you up for success later? And do you have a favorite failure?
With my horses?
Anything.
With anything? Gosh, I'd have to think about that. I mean, I've had lots of failures in my life, and I think the thing with failure is it's just the attitude that you have towards it. I do believe that everything happens for a reason. I do believe in never giving up. I always look for the lessons to be learned in the things that I feel are, you know, unfair or don't happen, or happen without a reason that I can see. At the end of the day, I think it's just, I learned to, for the most part, and this is kind of probably like a Chinese philosophy or Buddhism, or, you know, wherever you go, it's like, it is looking for the joy in being in the present, you know, within reason, obviously. I think I always try to wake up every day and look at what am I grateful for, and look at the contribution that every failure or success in my past has contributed to what I do today. And finding Equitopia or building Equitopia has come on a bunch of failures. And it's the biggest gift to both me, my horses, and hopefully to a lot of the members that are signed up to our program, is to create that community of support, you know, that allows a larger impact on the lives of horses, and that flows onwards to owners. Because I do believe if we learn how to have the kinds of qualities that we need to have to be successful around horses, being patient, developing the skills to listen, then it actually translates into our personal lives, our ability to have better relationships with others, to be more patient, to be more accepting, to be happier with less, to, you know, try to have an attitude of gratitude. I heard that somewhere before. I thought it was nice. Attitude of gratitude. And I think that's the gift to myself from my failures, and both my gift and my inspiration from my failures is my ability to approach this this venture in a way that hopefully will impact the lives of horses in a way that is bigger than what I could do personally myself with, you know, just having 14.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really beautiful. I feel like that's why I love working with people and their horses, and why it's so rewarding, because how you interact with your horse is a reflection of how you interact with the world, others, and yourself. And by transforming your perspective, you're able to transform all other aspects of your life. And it can just bring more joy into the world. And what are books that you recommend most? Or do you have, like, a favorite book that has really influenced you?
Well, I think all the books I picked my consultants for a reason. And so I think the books, you know, that they have written are probably influential and the ones that I always recommend. And from a personal, I mean, I have read books on Buddhism. I do think it's as important to read books on self-care and self-development as it is on the, you know, on the practical side of things. I think Pedro Chodron is one that I've read. I can't remember now, to be honest. I haven't. It's been a while since I read them. But I would say we are developing a list of recommended books, but I think mostly I pick my consultants based on not only, you know, what they teach in person, but because of the books they've written and how they've helped, like Gerd Heuschmann, Sue Dyson, Mary Wanless. Sorry, it's my dog.
That was very cute.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Hugh. This is a rescue dog. This is a husky dog. That came to my property a week to the day after I lost my 11-year-old German Shepherd. And I didn't want him. I called Animal Control to pick him up. They were on their way, and then they called back and said, no, we can't pick him up because the shelters are full. And I was like, dang it. So I drove to meet them, and he wasn't chipped. And on the way back, I saw a container that was called Pasha Freight, which was my dog that I'd lost. His name was Pasha. And so I took it as a sign that my old dog saw how distressed I was at his departure, that he sent me this new guy, Huey, and arranged the circumstances to be that I had no choice, really, except to keep him.
So look, he says, he was meant to be in your life.
He was meant to be in my life, and he has been a blessing. Yes, he's helped me navigate the loss of my darling Pasha, and he keeps me busy, and he is very entertaining, and I'm so glad that, again, the circumstances, you know, created the situation for me, and I fought it, but it was meant to be, and that's the way the universe works.
Yes, it is. And then the last one, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life?
It's mostly actually it's the breathing. It's like I have a very busy life. I've got 14 horses, I've got a ranch, I've got to Equitopia, and so sometimes I get too much in my own head. And so the practice that helps me the most is first being aware that I'm getting too much in my head and thinking about all the things that I need to do, and to start taking a deep breath and change that into an appreciation for being in the moment. You know, I love where I live. I love the ranch. There's so many things. You know, there's red-tailed hogs, there's rabbits, there's squirrels, there's the horses. You know, there's so much to appreciate just by looking around, not to mention the million other things that I am super grateful for. So it is really just, again, that idea of not being in my head so much and trying to be in the moment and appreciate and be grateful and happy for every single thing in my life.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for creating Equitopia in this podcast and having this conversation with me. I'm excited to share it.
The internet is jam-packed with information and opinions on how to care for your horse, but how do you know what to trust? Equitopia membership programs are especially designed for busy people who want research and evidence-based resources and support for the best horse and rider experience. Our members tell us that they love Equitopia's amazing whole horse, whole rider resources that are available 24/7 from anywhere in the world. We are humbled by the many testimonials from horse people who tell us that Equitopia was the missing piece in their horsemanship journey and that our platform has changed their lives and the lives of their horses. We would like to offer you 50% off of your first month in any of our membership plans and start becoming a better informed equestrian today with our exclusive members' webinars, videos, the Equitopia Academy, and much more to support you on your journey. Just go to equitopiacenter.com and use the code PODCAST in the checkout to get your membership at half price for the first month.